Loop Radio, brought to you by America's Great Loop Cruisers Association. We're dedicated to sharing Great Loop information and inspiration with those actively cruising, planning for, or dreaming about a Great Loop adventure. This is Kim Russo. I'm the director of AGLCA. Today, my guest is Tanya Binford, who has been our guest before. Tanya single-handed the Loop a few years back, and she has just finished a book about her experiences. So we wanted to invite her back to share some details about that. Before I do bring Tanya in, though, I'd like to take a moment, as I usually do, to recognize and thank our Admiral-level sponsors. They are Curtis Stokes & Associates, Dog River Marina, Passage Maker Trawler Fest, Skipper Bob Publications, United Yacht Sales of the Carolinas, and Waterway Guide Media. As always, we encourage our listeners to support these businesses that support the Great Loop. And with that business out of the way, Tanya, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you again.
Well, I'm so glad you could do this because I have had the opportunity to read the book, which I loved. And there are so many different things that kind of make you unique, but also a great lesson to people who think that they can't do the Loop for any particular reason. You kind of challenge those ideas in a lot of different ways. So let's start talking a little bit about why you decided to write a book about your Great Loop experiences.
Well, after I crossed my wake and returned home, I wasn't able to go back to my job, which I had really planned on returning to. And so there's this point in the book where I bring up, which to me was like a transformational time, and I wrote, you know, when I crossed Lake Ontario, there was fog all around and I couldn't see anything, but I knew my direction. And so that's kind of how I felt on the Loop. I could, no matter where I was and no matter what the weather was, I knew where I was going. But when I returned home, I felt like even though I could see everything, I didn't have any direction. So it was at that time that I decided to think about what other people had told me about life in general. And a lot of people had told me to write a book about my experiences. So that's how I decided to start. And then I went to a writer's group, which really pushed me to be brutally honest with myself and write the book that I wrote, which, you know, encompasses more than doing the Loop, but also the feelings and everything else associated with it.
And it definitely does. And one of the things I liked about the book is it's really, you really don't sugarcoat it. Sometimes when I'm out speaking about the Great Loop and I bring in gold loopers, and most people have a fabulous experience on the Loop, but every once in a while I hear from the attendees, is it really that great? Everybody talks about how wonderful it is. And it is, but there are, of course, some challenges, and we'll get into those in a little bit. But tell us a little bit about your life before you started the Great Loop.
You know, I was probably somewhat of a workaholic. My passion is public mental health and working as a psychiatric nurse practitioner. And so, you know, every day I'm talking to patients. I had my clinic, my coworkers, you know, and they meant the absolute world to me. But oftentimes when talking to patients, you know, it seems like the problems are brought up and the limitations. And so people would always say, well, I can't do this, and these are like 10 reasons why I can't do something. And so encouraging my patients to say, you know, but what are the things you can do, and what would you like to do, and where do you want to see your life going? You know, I also had to kind of look at myself and say, well, what would I like to be doing differently? Or in 5 years from now, if I had a goal, what would it be? So, you know, even goals that seem kind of far-fetched, you can kind of make them real. And so when I did this trip, I also, all my patients kind of kept track of me and where I was on the trip. So it was also about showing them that, like, you can do whatever you want to do. Just come up with a plan, come up with a goal, and make it happen.
And that's one of those typical things about the Loop that I really think that you challenged and kind of shattered some people's impressions, which is that you have to wait till you're retired to do this. So, again, one of those things that I really kind of liked about the book is it's different than a lot of the stories we read about the Great Loop. So people hear about a woman single-handing the Loop, and actually anybody who single-hands the Loop, and just kind of automatically think, well, that person must be a lifelong boater. They must have lots and lots of experience. So this, you know, wasn't scary to them at all. But that's not the case with you. So tell us about how you got involved in boating. and to the level that you wanted to spend this amount of time aboard a boat?
So, you know, it goes back to being at work, and I'm in the middle of the desert in Arizona, and I was having these thoughts about sailing. I was telling patients, like, you know, when I turn 50, I'm going to go sailing for like 6 months. And I really honestly had no clue what that looked like. I didn't know anything about it. I knew nothing. So the opportunity came up for me to move to the coast and keep the same job that I had with my patients. So I did that. I moved to the coast. And so like the first 50 pages of the book is dedicated to that 3.5 years before I started the loop of learning about boating. But I really knew nothing. There's a part in the book where my son and I, an oil alarm has gone off on this boat that we had rented, and we went in to figure out what we needed to do, and the guy looked at us and asked us if it was a 2-stroke or 4-stroke engine. And neither of us knew anything what he was talking about. We just looked at each other with these blank stares because we really knew nothing. So we had to learn, you know. So we took sailing classes, and we did some things. And, well, that's what you do. If you don't know something, you learn. You try. But I don't know that anything gets you quite as prepared when you go on the loop. That day that you leave the dock, that's when a lot of learning took place.
Sure. And like I said, one of the things that I really liked about the book is you really didn't kind of sugarcoat the challenges of the experience. You talk very openly about some of the things that really didn't go as well as they should have. So now, having put a few years between you and those experiences, what were the biggest challenges, and were they even greater challenges than you had imagined before you started?
You know, there were a lot of challenges, and like, even at the very beginning of the story, we were 2 weeks into it, and I was having major mid-engine type problems with lots of engine kind of problems. With my engine mounts were broken. I had water coming in through my stuffing box. But, you know, the challenge of getting that fixed, you know, first of all, you take care of it, and it's a matter of, you know, you have to write the check to get it repaired. But for me, the bigger challenge of that experience was watching all my friends leave Norfolk from the rendezvous ahead of me and kind of getting left behind. And so it was, you know, how that to me was a bigger challenge. And then another time I was in the Erie Canal, and I had been really kind of, my boat had been tossed around a couple of the locks, you know, and I was so tempted to turn around and go home. And so, you know, how do you get through that and keep moving forward? And I think what pushed me forward was not wanting to go back through those 2 locks. You know, otherwise, I might have turned around. But, you know, so it's those moments that you have that you're going, oh, my gosh, what the heck am I doing? This isn't really what I signed up for. And then, you know, you do it anyway, and you learn from that, and you keep moving forward.
And the experiences in those 2 locks, and for the book is called Crossing the Wake. I don't know if we've mentioned that yet. But when you read it, you can almost feel your pain, because you not only had the frustration and kind of the scariness of having trouble in some locks and single-handing, but you also ended up with some bruised arms from that. And I'm guessing that was one of your major kind of pride buster moments that you talk about, and I liked that phrase. So talk a little bit about pride buster moments that everyone has on the loop and how they're shared over docktails as kind of part of the looper lore.
Yeah. Well, so that particular experience, you know, a bunch of us ended up, you know, docking for the night, and we talked about it over dinner and over docktails and the different people who had experiences in the locks and how they handled those experiences, which is really great. I owe that term to actually Burke from Estrelita, Burke and Stowe. I got to travel with them a little bit along the way, and my mom just loved that expression, pride buster moments from Burke. But I remember probably my biggest pride buster moment was after I had crossed the Gulf, and I was in this little town, Steinhatchee, you know, and I mean, by now I had been docking for a long, long time, and I thought I was pretty damn good at docking, but I wasn't paying attention, and the current had changed directions, and I had the worst docking experience of the entire loop at that little marina. And, of course, I was being watched by all these fishermen.
Of course.
So there was a whole bunch of people watching me. And I felt like I just felt smaller than small and puny. And, you know, I held my head low. And I thought, you know, that's what I get. You know, I was a little too cocky. But, you know, we all have those. And they come up at the, you know, throughout, I guess, the loop, they come up. And so being able to talk about it afterwards and laugh about it and say, oh, my gosh, yeah, I remember when I did that, you know, it makes a difference.
Well, and I'm sure you'd be hard-pressed to find a looper who has not had several of those pride buster moments, or any boater in general. I think we all have them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, and you do talk about a lot of the other loopers who were looping at that same time frame as you. And you talk a lot about a looper named John who gave you the gift of confidence. And that had to do with, I think, with some of the maintenance on your boat. So tell us about that gift of confidence.
Yeah. He actually helped me, kind of pushed me to change my alternator belt, which is really an easy thing to do. And, you know, when I was home before I did the loop, you know, if I needed to change my alternator belt or do something like that, my son would say, okay, this is how you do it, Mom. And then he'd get frustrated with me, and he would do it for me, which was really great. You know, I could totally take advantage of that. however, you know, at this particular time, my alternator belt was loose, and I needed to change it. And I was perfectly content waiting for the marine mechanic to come over and take a look at it. And change it for me. I would have been happy doing that. And John was like, no, Tanya, you are going to get down and you are going to change that damn thing, because there will be times when you're on the loop that you're not going to have somebody around that can come and change it for you, you know. So forget it. You need to do it yourself. And so I did, and I was grateful. In some ways, I felt like a child being, you know, scolded by their parent. But it was good. It was in a good way, because I did it. I got it done. And later on the loop, when I had to change things out, it was, you know, it just made it a lot easier. So.
Right. Well, and your boat's name is Annabelle. So tell us about Annabelle. What kind of boat is it?
Annabelle is a 25-foot Ranger tug. Great little boat. And I named her after my granddaughter. My son had shown me the Ranger tug on the computer, and it seemed to be a boat that had everything. And for me, it was a boat that I felt I could handle. And so, again, not coming from a boating world, I wanted something that I felt comfortable in, that I could personally handle myself, that wasn't going to be too big for me. And so that's why I chose the Ranger tug. Yeah.
And so 25-foot Ranger tug, and she you have since sold Annabelle, correct?
I have. That was a sad, sad day. And I miss having my boat. Small boat. But, yeah, I miss her.
Well, and really not a small boat by most standards. Perhaps a little small by some looping standards, but certainly not the smallest boat the loop has been done in. And certainly for someone single-handing, I think a small boat is a great choice. But you did have a guest aboard for a little while, and that was your mom in kind of close quarters. So what did you learn from that experience that you might be able to share with future loopers about when they do have guests aboard?
Yeah, so having my mom aboard was really hard, because it was really hard getting her place where she could sleep in a comfortable way. And so we ended up getting the table up, and we just left it. So we left it so that her bed was always there, which meant that we had even less room to get around on the boat. And so it was tight space. And I had this brilliant idea, which may not have been so brilliant afterwards, that I wanted to give my mom this experience of anchoring out, which, I mean, in some ways it's really good because it was so peaceful and calm, but on the other hand, that meant that we were in this small space for day after day without really being able to walk around. And we couldn't really step away from each other if it was getting tense. So, I don't know, I kind of compare it to, you know, what's it like to spend 10 days in a, or 3 days in a closet with your mom? You know, like, at some point it gets stressful. And so it wasn't, you know, and so after the third night, the fourth night, the fourth day, my sister picked her up and took her home. It was hard. It wasn't the easiest 3-4 days. And so I think if you have a bigger boat and you have more space, it, you know, lends itself to having company better. But when you have a small boat, you really have to think about that. Is there room for people to walk around, sit, relax, enjoy themselves, or are you going to be? And also, she's not a boater. So my original thought was, oh, my gosh, my mom's going to be here. I can let her take the helm. I'm going to be able to go to the bathroom and relax. Like, I'm not going to have to be running, you know. I'm not going to have to be on high alert all the whole time. However, she was always looking at the electronics, and she had a difficult time looking out the window. Like, when she was following along where we were at, her eyes were glued to the iPad. So at one point, she took the helm, and we were, like, heading straight towards a boat. And I was like, Mom, seriously, are we going to, like, kill the man? What are we doing here? So my ideas of sharing helm responsibility didn't quite work out the way I wanted. So I guess you have to consider that, too. Consider who your company is, and are they going to be able to help out, or is it going to be one more thing for you to worry about?
Great points. I'm going to take a quick pause and play a message from one of our sponsors, and then we'll come back and continue our discussion with Tanya Binford. Be back in a moment.
Winter Harbor Marina is located on the Oneida River, 1.5 miles west of Oneida Lake in Brewerton, New York, just minutes from Syracuse International Airport. Winter Harbor offers the lowest diesel fuel and gas prices from New York City to Canada. If you find a lower posted documented price, they will match it. Their amenities include complimentary courtesy vehicle, 24-hour pay-at-the-pump fueling, dockside water and cable TV, pristine bathrooms and showers, and emergency haul-out service. For more information, call 315-676-9276 or visit www.winterharborllc.com. Winter Harbor is a proud Commander sponsor of AGLCA.
We're back on Great Loop Radio. Our guest today is Tanya Binford, who has just written a book called Crossing the Wake about her experiences single-handing the Great Loop. Tanya, let's focus a little bit on some of the people aspects of the Great Loop, because it is a very social trip. You know, you're traveling kind of on the same path at roughly the same speed as a bunch of other loopers. And in this conversation, you mentioned kind of getting left behind after the spring rendezvous because you were doing some repairs on Annabelle. So you talk a lot about Mark and Jane aboard Average Looper. And, you know, early on they were a support system for you, so you were really wanting to keep up with them. But then as you continued the loop and got more miles, you actually started to push ahead of some of your looper friends. So what were the reasons behind that? What was that shift from, you know, being worried about falling behind to actually pushing a little bit ahead?
Yeah, I don't know that I ever intentionally pushed ahead. And so very early on, I learned that it was the weather and the seas that were going to affect me, because my boat was 25 feet. And like Mark and Jane, they had a Bayliner 4988, which is almost 50 feet long. So their boat speed was, they like to run, I think, at 12, 13, 14 knots, whereas I was running at 7 knots. So there were times, though, that the water was so incredibly beautiful and so peaceful and so calm and so tranquil, you know, where it's just glistening like glass. And you're sitting there going, okay, is this the time to stop or is this the time to go? And so if you're in a boat like mine, you're thinking, this is the time to go. Like, I have to take advantage of really calm weather and calm water. And so there was a time that everybody was at Solomon's Island, and I could have easily pulled over and gone to Solomon's Island with everybody. And that was definitely one of the places I wanted to stop. But the water was so good that day on the Chesapeake, and I had just had a couple really rough days on the Chesapeake, so I pushed forward. So really it had everything to do with weather. And then, again, getting through Chicago, like I had gotten through Chicago, and it was, I think, somewhere like August 22nd or something. So I was heading, and I had spent a couple days in Chicago, spent a couple days in Hammond, Illinois. So I'm ready to go down, start down the rivers. And so I headed down the rivers, and then not too long after I got down the rivers, there was flooding in the Mississippi. So most of the loopers got stuck in Alton or Grafton. Well, meanwhile, I was clear downstream. Mm-hmm. So, and the rivers are almost like a freeway. I mean, when you go down the rivers, you can get, you go pretty fast. So, you know.
Yeah, having that current assisting you is a pretty nice thing sometimes.
It is. And so, you know, I made it down the rivers. And so by the time, yeah, so by the time the Fall Rendezvous came about, I was like 3 weeks from home, two, 3 weeks from home. So, you know, but it certainly was never an intentional, my goal was actually like I wanted to stay around other loopers. I wanted to stay around people I knew, other boaters. However, if the weather was beautiful, I was on the water.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the key point. I actually went, my average speed was 7 knots. And mm-hmm. so when I was coming across Lake Okeechobee or approaching Lake Okeechobee, I remember looking up and there was this guy on a bicycle riding his bike. And it was, you know, he had one of those bikes with a basket, a beach bike. And he mm-hmm. wasn't going all that fast. It's not like he was pushing. And I was like, wow, we're going the same speed.
know,
that is my speed right there.
That's so true, yeah.
So, in the
end, you had originally planned, you know, about a year, but in the end you did the loop in a closer to 6 months. So, you know, what was kind of the reason for that? Was it largely just kind of taking advantage of those nice weather days, or was there another reason that you kind of went faster or traveled more than you anticipated?
I think it was mostly the weather days,
mm-hmm.
The good weather. And the other, and I guess there's another part of it, and that is a lot of couples will go to the Bahamas or stay in Florida and winter in Florida or the Bahamas. And so, and staying in Florida and the Bahamas was never really part of my agenda because I've been to Florida, I've spent time in Florida. So, and then being there by myself wasn't, you know, I wasn't going to go to the Bahamas by myself. To me, that sounds like a romantic adventure that you want to
mm-hmm.
do with somebody. And so I wasn't, yeah, that wasn't going to happen.
Right. Well, and let's talk a little bit. You were very open in the book about a love interest that wasn't traveling with you on the loop, but was certainly a support system for you. And partway through the trip, it kind of became evident, I guess, that that was not going to be a long-term relationship. So how did that affect your plans for the rest of the loop, if at all?
Yeah, you know, that was towards the very end. And so literally I was like 3 weeks from getting home. By then I had passed, by then I was no longer seeing anybody else from the loop. And so I think I was feeling pretty much alone. So I was like, okay, I just want to go home. So, mm-hmm. and that was probably the hardest part of the book for me to write about. That was,
mm-hmm.
that was where I had to become really brutally honest with myself. And so I don't know that that affected how long it took me. It's just that I was already so close to home that it was like, you know what, I could be home in 3 weeks. I'm just going to go. So I ended up stopping along the way a couple times due to weather and things. Like I ended up spending a few days in Daytona Beach. And I wrote about that, the Biketoberfest. That was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But a little scary. But, you know, I did get home, and I did get home earlier than I ever anticipated. So,
mm-hmm. And there are several mentions in the book about, you know, you're very frank about certain times that you were somewhat lonely doing the loop by yourself or wishing that you had somebody there to share in the challenges but also in the adventure. So you've mentioned that you may try to do the loop again someday. Do you think that you would single hand again, or do you think you would only do it if you had a first mate to go along with you?
You know, it's really hard to tell. I would definitely prefer having somebody to go with me if, you know, that right person came along. Because there are those moments, and some of them are priceless when you're sitting there at sunset, you know, looking out over the water, or first thing in the morning, you know, when the air is crisp. There are some times that you wish you had somebody there to share that with. So definitely that would play a huge part in it. I would much, much rather do it with somebody. And that was something I learned, because at the beginning when I left, it was like, I don't need anyone to do this with me. Like, why would I, like, I almost kind of felt bad for married couples that they had to put up with each other, you know? So, but by the time I was done, it was like, okay, I get it. I get it already. So, yeah, you know, it would be great to do the loop again. It would be great to do it with somebody. I would do it in a heartbeat. Of course, you know, now I'm kind of back to working, and I have to save up money again because I probably can't retire for another 10 years. So I... Well, maybe 12 or 15, I don't know. But yeah, so
yeah.
I would definitely prefer to do it with somebody, I think.
So, Tanya, as we wrap up, a lot of loopers tell me about, you know, it being a big adjustment to getting used to life on land again, and a lot of them aren't even trying to adjust to going back to work. So how has that adjustment been for you?
It's been a tough adjustment, and I kind of bring that up at the end of the book because I fully expected to go back to the job that I left. I had been told they were going to hire me. I was told, yeah, your job is here. And so I had planned on that. And then when I came back, I found out that I wasn't going to get my old job back, which was really difficult for me and kind of didn't help me find my direction. And so for probably a good year after I got back, it was trying to figure out where I'd kind of fit in a little bit better. So I took a couple different jobs. And the job I have now is actually not the job I finished the book with. The book ended last December, but now I'm back to working for a company that I worked for many years ago called Cebus, which is working out really, really well. But I also haven't gone back to work full-time. I've gone back to work pretty much part-time because I have focused on writing the book, and so that became a different part of my journey. And then I think it's important for anybody coming back from the loop to have something that they can focus on. I think a lot of us have a difficult time transitioning back into, you know, our land life. So Mark and Jane, for instance, they opened a bed and breakfast, but they also built their house. It actually took them less time to build their house than it did for me to write this book. So I'm kind of jealous.
It sounds like it's been a labor of love, though.
Yeah, for both of us, right? And so, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's interesting because I think we all need that something there to focus on when we get back. So even if it's not going to be the same, and I guess nothing is ever the same. So, you know, you're moving forward and nothing is ever going to be the same. And so you have to find something new to focus on.
Well, yeah. Crossing the Wake is a great read, a wonderful looping story because it kind of reads as a narrative, but fills you with information, but still is a very nice read with lots of storytelling in there. So I really enjoyed it. Tanya, tell us where we can get Crossing the Wake.
Well, the official release date is September 20th, and so right now it's available for pre-order on Amazon. And we found out the other day that you can even get it in Amazon Canada, so that was good. Beyond that, I do have a webpage, crossingthewake.com, and so there will be a link where people can order it on there. Or if anybody wants to email me, I can send them a copy now. And my email address is tanya@crossingthewake.com. So,
and Tanya, I don't think I've even shared this with you yet, but we did build in the greatloop.org ship store. We added that as a product, and it's just a link that clicks through to the Amazon pre-order for now. And then when it's available on crossingthewake.com, we'll shift it over to that. So you can get to the Amazon
Perfect.
Pre-order that way, too, if it makes it a little bit easier for people who are already on our site. Tanya, again, I completely enjoyed the book. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And thank you for joining us. We are out of time. Thank you all for listening. We will be back next week with another episode of Great Loop Radio. Until then, thanks for listening.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates. Home insurance provided and serviced by other select insurers.